When Julia Wallace started in newspapers, women weren't even allowed to smoke in the newsroom. It wasn't ladylike. That and many other stories of women in journalism are part of her new book, There's No Crying in Newsrooms. She and co-author Kristen Gilker join us to talk about their analysis and advice for women leaders in any industry. Plus, our state and national parks are open to all, but not everyone feels included in outdoor activities. An online community called Unlikely Hikers is changing that by encouraging people from underrepresented backgrounds to get outside.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, how an online community formed around more diverse representation in hiking in the outdoors. It's called Unlikely Hikers, and over the past few years, it's grown to tens of thousands of people. Its founder and the guy behind another group called Midwest Color Camp join us. But first, ever since the 1980s, women have poured into journalism schools. They now make up between two-thirds and three-quarters of journalism students, yet they still account for just about a third of those employed in the news media. And so, when it comes to leadership, it's no surprise the numbers look pretty dismal. Just 5 of the 25 largest newspapers have female editors. So, how far have we really come from a time when women were referred to as news hens and the only path into a newsroom was as a secretary? That's the question asked by longtime female journalism leaders Julia Wallace and Kristen Gilger in their new book that just came out, There's No Crying in Newsrooms. Together, they chronicle and analyze not just the past few decades of female leadership across newsrooms, but also provide advice for those who are now coming up. Julia is now a professor and Kristen the associate dean at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University, and both of them are on the line with me now from there. Julia, Kristen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Julia, I should say welcome back to Illinois, at least to our airwaves.
It's very exciting. Yep. I grew up in Rock Island and I went to school at Northwestern, and then I was the managing editor of the Sun-Times in the 90s. So I have deep Illinois roots.
Julie, I wonder if we could start with that, because you started at the Rock Island Argus, right, as an intern in 1975. Were there a lot of women in the newsroom when you first started?
No, actually. So when I walked in, there were very few. There was a women's department. Back then, newspapers had women's departments, and that's where the women worked. And then in the newsroom, there were very few women. In fact, one of the news reporters came up to me, a woman news reporter, and said very proudly that she had just fought that women were able to wear pants in newsrooms, because until then they all had to wear skirts. And so it was just beginning to break in. One of the stories that I like about the Argus is the Argus was owned by the Potter family back then, and Mrs. Potter ran the paper, and she didn't think it was ladylike for women to smoke. And so all the women would go into the bathroom to smoke. Men would smoke. You know, literally, you'd have the city editor
this is
was
back
sitting
when
there.
Everyone smoked in newsrooms.
Exactly, right. The city editor's there with, yeah, exactly, ashes on his pants, you know, just a complete mess. But women weren't allowed to smoke. But no one told me, so I just sort of sat down and lit up. And then that weekend, someone comes up to me and says, oh, you broke the ban on women smoking in the newsroom. I'm so proud of you. And I was like, oh, okay.
Kristen, what was it like when you first started in newspapers?
Very much as Julia described, where women were in the feature sections typically. And there were women starting to move into the harder news sections. But there were a couple of enclaves where you just rarely, if ever, saw a woman. And that was in editorial departments, sports departments, and business.
So it was crazy to me to read that someone like Judy Woodruff started as a news secretary, and I feel like this almost sounds like a Mad Men episode, but I wonder if you guys can explain what it was like for her generation when she started.
Well, she tells the story of trying to get a job at a television station and going in for an interview and them telling her, we already have a female reporter, because one was apparently the limit. And so she and other women who we talked to, like Marcy McGinnis, for example, at CBS, you know, they sort of took whatever jobs that they could, and they started at the bottom and worked their way up.
And I don't think that a lot of them knew what it could lead to. You know, I was an intern at the Atlanta Journal at one point, and if you had said to me back in 1977 when I interned there that one day you'll be the editor here, I would have never believed that. I mean, I think, you know, we all thought we'd become great reporters, that we'd get to a certain point, but I think just the concept of eventually running the place was not even in our wildest dreams.
And when we think about that and fast forward to today, I wanted to ask you all about last month, five women sued the cable channel New York One for age and gender discrimination. And I imagine to both of you, especially after all of the research you did for this book, the more than 100 people that you interviewed, maybe that wasn't that much of a surprise. But do you think that viewers or readers, people who consume the news, think those days are behind us?
I think that's a really good question. I guess we'll find out, right? So Nora O'Donnell is going to be the anchor of CBS Evening News beginning in July, and hopefully she'll do really well and viewers will accept her. But I think that people probably aren't surprised. And I think it's part of the credibility problem that news organizations have. The reality is we don't reflect our communities, you know, and gender is just one of the variables of that. And if you don't reflect your community, you can't know your community, and therefore you cannot cover it well. So it's not just about the numbers. It's a much bigger story that really goes to the heart of how the news media does its job.
I do think that young women today, as they enter news organizations, sort of think all the problems have been solved. And I think it's a surprise to them when they find out, maybe there are still some issues remaining here. At least that's what a number of young women told us, and what we have heard from our daughters and the many young women who we teach who go out into the business. So I think, you know, they think the gender wars have been won, and there has been a lot of progress. And I think we document the progress that is made as well, but not as much as you might think. And when we talk to women who came up in the business in the 80s and 90s, they say they're absolutely shocked at how many of the issues still remain, that things have not changed more than they have.
I'm speaking with Kristen Gilger and Julia Wallace. They're the co-authors of There's No Crying in Newsrooms. Kristen, is that why you wanted to write this?
Because of crying in newsrooms?
No, because of what you were just saying about women in the 80s and 90s not being aware of those stories, but then also being very aware of issues that still need to be fixed.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it was driven by the things we were hearing from young women going into newsrooms, telling us about the issues they faced, and us reacting like, really? I mean, we know there are still issues, but... And then the other thing that I think really drove us was, this was a transformative time in the news industry, with many women entering newsrooms, you know, in the post-Watergate era. And no one had ever really captured those stories. There's some history about women in news that goes way back, but there's a whole era here that we felt had not been documented or captured. And these women have absolutely amazing stories to tell. They're funny stories and hair-raising stories and sad stories and sometimes all three of those things at the same time.
Julia, when we think about this also, when you think about the wave of just the amount of women post-Watergate entering journalism, I wonder what it looks like today. I mentioned a statistic about newspapers. What do numbers look like for women in news leadership across, regardless of the media, across the country?
So it's comparable. In digital media, it's a little better, but not significantly. And in TV, it's about the same. I mean, the fact is, ABC News has never been led by a woman. You know, CNN has never been led by a woman. CBS just named their first woman this year, Susan Zirinsky. I think that it's true throughout the industry, and media is just a case study, right? It's not as if media is unique. We look a lot like organizations. You know, you talked about Mad Men. We don't look that different than Mad Men sort of genre, or, you know, pick your specialty. And I think one of the things that we thought as we wrote this is it's a little more interesting because newsrooms are a little more interesting. But hopefully the stories that we tell and the lessons that we offer apply to all women who are in work that was once heavily male and has sort of begun to change. And I think, you know, those lessons apply. So I have a daughter in marketing, I have a daughter in law, and I think they can get as much out of the book, hopefully, as someone who's working in a newsroom.
And I think when you say that, when we think about certain generations of women, they're also, and regardless of the generation of a woman when they became a leader, I do think there is a conversation that you have in the book about how many women moderated their personalities or their management styles because they didn't want to be seen as too pushy or too bossy. Kristen, do you feel like that may represent a specific generation?
No. I think it was true before. It was true 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's still true today. And many, many of the women we interviewed talked about this. And there's actually a fair amount of research, the sort of more limited range of leadership styles available to women. The characteristics that we attribute to leadership, to leaders, are typically male characteristics. You know, it's being decisive and strong and competent and those sorts of things. And those are characteristics that are required for women to be leaders. But it's with a caveat. You have to be commanding, but not too commanding. You have to also be nice. You know, you have to be decisive, but not so decisive that you're not seen as someone who is collaborative and collegial with people.
Or you get the label difficult, right?
Yeah.
I've certainly never heard that one.
Yeah. Right. Christiane Amanpour would call it bitchy. So there's a narrower range of behavior that sort of is available to women. And we talk to women all along that spectrum. I mean, some like Christiane or some who are just really unapologetic about just being very strong and not letting guys talk over her, etc. And on the other hand, women who had a much softer leadership style, where they got things done, but in a very subdued kind of way. So there are different styles that will work for women, but they generally have to be careful about taking on the kind of persona or styles that usually work or often work for men.
Yeah, I loved one of the stories is about Diane McFarlane, who was the publisher in Sarasota, Florida. And she was the ultimate of sort of velvet gloves. And one of her staffers talked about how they could always tell when she was upset because her eyebrow would arch. And that's as much as you got.
It worked.
Very different style, right? And I think that's, as you say that, I wonder, when you think about women leading organizations, and you have an interesting case study of Mother Jones, of the two women who co-edited that, when women are in charge, what do you feel like has happened in general, you find, to the culture of a workplace, to the culture of a news organization?
Yeah, I was very interested in that question. And Mother Jones is a good example, but also where Diane was, Diane McFarlane at Sarasota, because that was headed by three women. And in fact, Julia and I worked together at a news organization, the Statesman Journal in Salem, Oregon, that was like all led by women. And so we have some personal experience with that. The research is a little unclear. Generally speaking, researchers will say that news judgment, news decisions do not change dramatically with women in charge, in part because to be successful, you're adopting sort of the male judgment of the newsroom around you. But certainly, in some cases, news judgment does change. I mean, I think Diane, for example, would argue that her paper, and we would say that too in Oregon,
we
would go after stories and have different takes on stories than might be true under male managers. But certainly the culture changes in a newsroom. In our newsroom, I'll tell this story on Julia. We had so many women in charge, Julia decided we should have Barbie Day in the newsroom. And so we all came to work one day dressed as Barbies based on the news. So we had a city editor who was prison Barbie and set up a wire fence around her desk that reporters had to navigate in order to get their stories edited. And I do think that you tend to have, in a newsroom that's run by women, you know, more attention to things like work-life balance, like family-friendly policies, and more of a talkative, collegial atmosphere. Janet Coates described the conversations in the Sarasota newsroom as being, you know, very circular, going from A to C to D and back to A again before a decision was made. But it made people really feel like they were part of the process.
You know, one funny story about that is when we were in Salem, we had mostly women working for us, and my boss was a woman. And but there was a new male city editor had started, and the male features editor sort of, I overhear this conversation where he says to him, "When they say, don't you think it'd be a good idea, that's not really a question." And I was like, yeah, we probably aren't quite as direct sometimes.
They just want you to do it.
Yes.
I'm speaking with Julia Wallace and Kristen Gilger, both of them co-authors of There's No Crying in Newsrooms. We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 41% of women in media report being sexually harassed by a colleague. That's the highest of any white-collar group. That's one fact I learned in There's No Crying in Newsrooms, which is a new book out just last week from ASU journalism faculty Julia Wallace and Kristen Gilger. The two interviewed more than 100 journalists. Their stories inform the analysis and advice within the book. Julia and Kristen are with me now from the Walter Cronkite School. Can I just ask you, when we're thinking about the whole idea of sexual harassment in newsrooms and the Me Too movement, we were just talking about the role that women play when they're leading news organizations. And when we think about the Me Too cultural shift, I wonder how much you think that cultural shift happened because people like Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey pushed the New York Times to do stories on Harvey
Weinstein. It's a really interesting story. So it actually emerged out of Trump coverage. When there were all these stories about, you know, his sexual harassment, they were in a room brainstorming at the New York Times what other coverage they could be. And Jodi said, this is just, you know, one piece of the story. There is a much bigger story, and we need, you know, that affects all these women and all these professions, and we need to unmask these people. And that's how it began. I mean, it was really, you know, again, as we talked about earlier, there were enough women in the room to really get some action going and make a difference. And this sort of goes to the point, if you don't have diverse newsrooms, you wouldn't have had those conversations. And I give the Times a lot of credit for amazingly strong reporting on that.
And I wonder, when we think about culture now, as you're thinking about the whole idea, I couldn't help but think when you were talking about, we've just had the Women's World Cup. And when we look at the U.S. team and how much people are having a conversation about a way that they have modeled athleticism, which is a little bit different than we've seen female athletes maybe in the past, or just in a way that they have been very confident and self-assured and just kind of handled themselves in a way that maybe people aren't used to seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the younger generation is much less willing to put up with some of the things our generation put up with than earlier generations. We thought that, you know, basically keep your head down, work really hard, be better than everybody else, stick it out, bring other women up behind you, and that would solve the problems. Clearly, that isn't enough. And it's really heartening, I think, that young women today are much more likely to call it out.
And to that point of that story, it was kind of a horrifying story in the book about Nina Totenberg telling a story about being at the White House. And I believe this was either in the 80s or the 90s, right?
This wasn't a recent story.
But about a public official. It was the 90s. A public official that put his hand on her leg at a White House dinner. And she said what was going through her head was she was thinking, you can't make a scene at the White House. And so she held this guy's hand for the whole dinner and she ate with one hand with the theory the hand couldn't move if she
That's
held
right.
It.
It's crazy. And I think though, I love that story. When she told me that story, I wasn't surprised because I think all of us from back in the 80s and 90s, it was just sort of part of your life and you had to sort of figure out how to deal with it. And people dealt with it in different ways, but the way she dealt with it, I'd say, was probably the norm.
I remember Janet Leach, who's one of the women that we interviewed who used to edit a newspaper in Ohio, said, you know, a lot of things happened, but I didn't pay much attention to it. I just didn't give it that much space in my head.
So I'm a decade after, because I started in journalism in the 2000s. So I started working around 2000 was when I became a full-time journalist. And when I was, actually, as I was preparing for this conversation, I was talking to the production staff about my versions of this are sort of just like things guests say to you that are inappropriate, either usually not on air, but they're just, and I always thought of them as just, they are like, I think the way that I've thought about it is also kind of a shade of this, of like, this is just part of the territory and this is kind of how things work. I wonder how many of the women you spoke with, did any of them feel like they had regrets about the way they handled
things?
Oh, I
think we all do. I think we all feel like we needed to speak up more because I think, you know, it's part of why Kristen and I decided to write this book. I mean, we look back and think, we both have daughters in their 20s and we thought, yes, we know we have to put up with this, but it will be better for their generation. And it's better, but it's not good enough. And so I think we wish, and I think a lot of the women we talked to wish, that we had done more. And yeah, it would have been harder and there would have been a lot of missteps, but maybe we would have been further along.
And we also might have lost our seat at the table. I mean, we were dealing with real realities. Some of the young women that we talked to say that they think what they're facing is similar to what we face, but more subtle. And because it's more subtle in some ways, that almost makes it harder to deal with, which I thought was a really interesting observation.
I think that is an interesting observation. I'm speaking with Julia Wallace and Kristen Gilger, who are the co-authors of There's No Crying in Newsrooms. And when you guys think about that, the whole idea, I think it's obviously everyone's going to look back on the past and think about what they could have done differently. But I was really interested in the fact that one of your case studies, again, going back to Mother Jones, an organization that was led by women, it still seemed that within that organization that women were reluctant to come forward when there were incidents of sexual harassment. And I wonder what that tells you about what needs to be done to change the culture, whether we're talking about newsrooms or any organization, with the whole notion of sexual harassment.
Yeah, when I talked to Claire and Monica, the who were the editors at the time of Mother Jones, they were stunned that this had happened on their watch. Because I think they thought the fact that we're here, right, and that we're trusted and known as you know, advocates for women in the newsroom. This just wouldn't happen. But it does happen, and people still were reluctant to speak up. They feel like they took steps to ensure that wouldn't happen again by having lots and lots of conversations with the staff. But there's always going to be that built-in doubt, a self-doubt, like, oh, was it something I did? What could happen if I do say something? It's just me. It's nobody else. That you have all of those doubts that surface in those sorts of situations.
Well, and I think as leaders, we have to be much more intentional about changing culture. I think that part of the conversations that have happened since Me Too have really been about that culture change. And that plays out in all sorts of ways, including, you know, how you deal with working moms and how you deal with paid leave and all sorts of issues. But I think that a lot more attention has to be paid. It can't be the HR department off in the corner sort of issuing these policies. But leaders, you know, wherever they are, in newsrooms or elsewhere, need to really understand that that is their job. Their job is creating that culture to do great work.
And a lot of that has to do with policies and procedures and the things that, are, you know, are part of the core of how a news organization or any organization operates. And we haven't paid as much attention to the overall cultures and the policies as we need to.
Kristen, you mentioned working moms, and you write about this, that at this moment when women give birth, the theory often goes that once that happens, many women decide a family is more important to them than their careers. But I wonder what the research shows about that, if that's really the decision that happens.
Well, Gail Evans, who's written a lot about this, told us that she doesn't think that's what happens at all. She thinks that what happens is that when women enter workplaces, they think things are pretty equal, and they actually pretty much are in terms of beginning wages and beginning assignments and positions. And then maybe 10 years or so into a job, women are noticing inequities. And that is at about the time they're also thinking about having children. And she says that women drop out not because they're having children, but because the job hasn't lived up to their expectations.
So, Julia, your daughter was 6 months old when you became managing editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. Am I right? What lessons did you learn?
How to park a baby under your desk.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was, you know, I think I was really fortunate that I had a really supportive husband. I can't imagine how I would have done that. I think, you know, I think it's one thing that can't be underestimated. A lot of the women we talked to told stories like that. I think it's about you get really good at time management. You get really good at prioritizing. You know, as Kristen said, this was back before we had email and,
24/7.
Yeah. And so, you know, I needed to see the front page every night as part of my job before, you know, the end of the night. And if it was a late night with breaking news, it wouldn't be available when I left. And so there were a lot of nights where, you know, baby Emmeline would come back to work with me in her stroller and, you know, she'd color under the copy desk while I looked at the front page. And that just sort of was part of what I had to do.
Both of our girls sort of grew up in newsrooms. My girls remember I would be reading them bedtime stories and I'd get a call from the copy desk chief to review the front page headlines. And they would be chiming in on what that headline should say when they were about 6 years old. So maybe it's not a surprise one of them at least became a journalist.
And you guys wrote this book with advice at the end of each chapter. Why did you do that?
I don't know. I think we just sort of felt like we had all these experiences that we wanted to share. And it really was about our students. So we looked at our students and thought, you know, they're going out into this world, which is not what they expected. And they are finding issues they were not really thinking about. And to be able to give them some advice and not just tell stories seemed like it was a more positive, proactive approach as opposed to just documenting the history.
And I would add that because we tried to tell stories in this book, the chapters are very narrative. So it's telling somebody's story, typically. And being able to draw the lessons out of that, those stories, we thought was an important way to sort of come full circle on what we were trying to do. It also gave us a chance to tell some of our own stories.
Some.
There are more.
They're more than didn't end up in the book. So that brings us to the title of this, which is I will be very candid with you and say I have given especially the interns advice to that you should not cry in newsrooms. But then I realized later that I kind of had to modify that somewhat. You guys also used to give that advice, but did you change your mind about that?
Yes, for years that's the advice you gave. And Kristen came up with the title as we were sort of talking about it. But one of the interesting parts of the reporting is one of the chapters focuses on Melissa Bell, who's the publisher of Vox. And she's in her late 30s, and she cries. She actually cried, I think, 3 times during the interview with her. And her staff talks about it. But what she says, and I think this is so wonderful, is that she's sort of come to terms with it, that it is a human emotion. And that's part of who we are, and we need to sort of embrace it and sort of move on and not get so, you know, just, I mean, think about if we had that same sort of don't ever yell in a newsroom, you know, well, okay, you're not going to be yelling all the time, but there are moments when it's okay. And to getting that same point with crying would be a really good outcome.
We actually didn't come up with the title until after we had done all the interviews. And looking back, we realized how many women brought up this issue of crying in the newsroom or giving advice not to cry. Yeah,
or
go to the
bathroom.
You have to go to the bathroom
specific,
to
right?
cry.
Go to
or
the
go
bathroom
out to your
to
car.
Cry. Well, I think we've all done
car,
that.
Your car in the parking lot or something like that. And so it became almost a theme with as we talked to people about the book, they would bring this up.
Well, and it speaks to the issue that we had to make sacrifices to fit in. I mean, that's, you know, if you sort of look at it from the larger context, that's the point. And it sort of goes back to what you were asking before about how do we have to modulate our behavior in order to be successful in these professions?
This is a big question, but I wonder what you hope men take away from reading this book.
A lot. Everything. I have a lot of regrets, but one of the regrets I have is that we didn't talk more to the men. I mean, we spent a lot of time, and I had a large women support group, a lot of time talking with women about these issues. We did not engage men enough in those conversations. And if we're really going to change culture, which is what it's going to take, that's what's going to be necessary. And so I hope that, that men read the book and sort of see ways they can make a difference, because it's going to take both of us, both genders, to do that.
And I think men do want to be involved in the conversation.
Yeah.
Especially the young men who we teach and who we send out into the world. They're very open to this, but sometimes they just kind of don't know what to do or how to help. And they can be a huge part of making progress.
And frankly, I think with the Me Too movement, are nervous about what to say and what not to say.
And so from that, I wonder what else you learned, and in particular, if you all are pessimistic or optimistic about the future of women in journalism.
I'm very optimistic. I mean, we're lucky that we get to work with amazing and smart and talented and ambitious women every day. And we can see what difference they're making and the positions that they're getting and how they're changing newsrooms. So I'm actually very optimistic about it. And it also goes to what Julia said earlier about sort of the economic imperatives of, you know, being truly diverse in your newsrooms in order to cover diverse communities. And I think that's a message that's getting through.
That's Kristen Gilger, Senior Associate Dean at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She and Julia Wallace are co-authors of There's No Crying in Newsrooms, which just came out last week. Julia, Kristen, thanks for taking the time to speak with
me.
Thanks. Thank you. It was fun.
If you didn't hear the recent announcement, this is my last month hosting the 21st. I'm leaving to do a Knight Wallace Fellowship at the University of Michigan. Of course, the 21st will continue without me, but in the last few weeks I'm on the air, I'd love to hear from you listening about any last conversations you'd like me to have. Is there something you've been meaning to suggest that we cover? Let me know. You can email us at talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can send us a message on Facebook or Twitter. Coming up, we'll be talking to the guy behind Midwest Color Camp and the founder of another group called Unlikely Hikers. Both of them come from backgrounds where they didn't really camp or hike, but they've formed an online community of others like them. Why they're doing it and where they suggest getting outside in Illinois. We'll have that conversation just on the other side of this short break. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Summer's finally here, and if you don't mind the heat and sun, that means getting outside. And so many outdoor spaces in the U.S. are free and open to the public, whether you're looking for a short hike or a camping trip. But even though many of these spaces are open to everyone, that doesn't mean everyone's going. For instance, in 2017, just 7% of the people who visited national parks were Black. 78% were white. That can mean some outdoor enthusiasts don't see themselves represented when it's out on the trail or even in advertising. So some folks have taken upon themselves to build a community. Often these communities start online, but of course they take the form of group hikes and trips as well. Jenny Brusso is an outdoor writer and founder of one of those online communities, Unlikely Hikers. She lives in Portland, Oregon, where she joins us from. I also want to welcome Aaron O'Shea, the founder of Midwest Color Camp. He's on the line from Chicago. Jenny, Aaron, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me, Nyla.
So, Jenny, can I start by asking you about your own outdoor experiences? Did you grow up hiking and doing things outdoors?
I did not grow up doing outdoorsy things, and I never even really actually considered getting out into nature. I think that was sort of subconsciously also formed by the fact that I never really saw people like me doing outdoor recreation. As a plus-size queer person, I hadn't really seen that representation before. And so it never even really crossed my mind. But I moved to Portland as a young adult, and, you know, eventually, it's a huge part of the culture here. So eventually I started, you know, experimenting.
Experimenting with the outdoors. Aaron, how about you? Did you grow up hiking, doing things outside?
Absolutely not. I didn't really grow up with much nature, really at all, being from inner city Chicago. Most of the time, I kind of regarded nature as just like clouds in the sky when they would make some funky pattern. I'm like, oh man, that's so beautiful. That's nature. It wasn't really until a few years ago, I think I'm going on about 3.5 years now, that I've been getting outdoors. So it's extremely, I'm still new to the space, still learning, still figuring things out for sure.
It's interesting because I think sometimes people have families who grow up camping. I definitely did not have a family that grew up camping. We never camped. So I wonder, Aaron, that's maybe part of it as well, like what you grow up with. What for you changed about when you first realized that you loved being outside?
It's crazy because it was on my very first hike, so I am thankful I didn't need like multiple tries to get in tune. But on my very first hike, I got like dead into the center of the woods, and there was no technology. My phone signal was gone. There were no buildings, nothing. And I sat to like just take in the water and the scenery, and I started crying. And then like from that moment on, it kind of it's just grown and grown and grown, the urge and the desire to be outdoors.
Thanks for sharing that, Aaron. That sounds like that was a really powerful moment. Why do you think it was that way for you?
I feel like because I do definitely still think about it. And I feel like more than anything, it was just like this bath that I took that I didn't even know that I needed to take. And ever since, like, it's stuck with me, that cleansing, that renewing that I get when I go outdoors.
Jenny, for you, I wonder, when was the moment when you realized this is something I really love? I know you said that this is something you were kind of surrounded by in Portland. Did you have a aha moment like Erin did?
I did, yeah. Similarly to Erin, I went on a hike, and it wasn't really something that I chose to do. It was kind of like I was invited on one, and I just wanted to seem, you know, game for anything. And I really had no idea what I was getting myself into. But I also felt undeniably curious. So I went on this hike, and it was actually within Portland, so I didn't even have to go to some great distance to do so. And on this hike, you know, I definitely felt self-conscious about how hard I was breathing and sweating while I was, like, hanging out with my friends. But I felt like something was kind of opening inside of me. Like I was finding something that I needed. Like I felt this sort of undeniable connection with the outside in a way that I don't think I had ever really experienced before. And that curiosity just continued to grow. And from there, I started going on almost every hike I could around Portland. And you know, I just didn't stop.
So, Jenny, I wonder if you can tell us how Unlikely Hikers got into the picture here, how you went from that moment to starting an entire online community about inclusivity in the outdoors.
When I discovered hiking and what it was doing for my mental health and how it made me feel in my body, about my body, I was really excited about it. And I started following all kinds of outdoor initiatives and communities online on Instagram and whatnot. And I was very, very aware of the fact that I was not seeing people like me, a plus size person, queer people, on these accounts. And there was also a lot of other people I wasn't seeing too, people of color, you know, trans folks, just, I mean, really pretty much everyone who's not like a thin, white, young person. And I had a problem with that. I really needed to see something else in my feed. And so I started writing about my experiences outdoors and about this representation problem that I was seeing, and just sort of organically led to starting Unlikely Hikers. At first, it was just something to kind of change my feed. And it had such a big response from other people who were like, whoa, I needed this too. I needed to see something else, you know, a different outdoor story. And the people started asking for group hikes. That wasn't necessarily something I had ever planned to do, but now that's a huge part of Unlikely Hikers, is that I lead hikes in the Portland area once a month, and I'll do one other somewhere else within the U.S. every month.
And so the Unlikely Hikers Instagram page has more than 59,000 followers. Erin, is that how you got connected to Jenny?
Yes, actually, and it's crazy that we're both on the phone right now, because Jenny had a really big hand in the initiation of Midwest Color Camp. I started following Unlikely Hikers, and eventually me and Jenny connected, and she featured me on Unlikely Hikers Instagram page. And the engagement was so crazy because everyone was in the comments saying, I love the Midwest. I used to love going to Starved Rock. I used to love going camping and rafting in Missouri. And so I started looking up just like the nature that was outside of the immediate Chicagoland area. And it was crazy. It was just the amount of nature, the beauty that was all around. And as I was looking at these places, I realized that I didn't really see anyone of color just like blasted on front pages of travel websites and magazines. And I got really, really, really interested in changing that narrative.
And so when you think about changing that narrative, Erin, can I ask you what your group hikes are like now in terms of how many people come to Midwest Color Camp, like where you go, what you do?
So as of right now, Midwest Color Camp is not currently doing group hikes, but we are setting it up so that there can be like instructional classes and training, and the sign-ups and the people that are beginning to engage with coming to the trainings and the courses is really picking up.
And so where would you, and Jenny, have you done hikes with Aaron in Illinois, right? Where have you guys gone?
Actually, we weren't in Illinois, strangely enough. Aaron came all the way to Minneapolis to join me on an Unlikely Hikers group hike, and he was my co-lead.
Okay, still in the Midwest then, right? So
Yes.
I wanted to ask you guys, where are your favorite outdoor trips when we're thinking about the Midwest? Aaron, can I start with you?
Yeah, I have way too many, so I'll try to bring it in a little bit. So in Illinois, there is Shawnee National Forest. It's about 5.5-6 hours from Chicago. Inside of Shawnee National Forest is this space called Garden of the Gods, and it's literally the most beautiful place that I have been inside of the U.S. It's just these monumental brick and mortar, these treasures that I love Garden of the Gods. I think that's my favorite place. I could probably talk about it all day.
Jenny, what about you? What are some of your favorite hiking destinations in the Midwest?
You know, I have not done a lot of hiking in the Midwest, and that's actually something I'm working on right now because I feel like a lot of outdoor culture at parks and, you know, even advertising and things like that are
very
really,
coastal.
Yeah, they're very focused on the East and West Coast, and it's really easy to kind of fall into just paying attention to those areas, especially because there are so many people in the outdoors in on the coast, and they're the loudest online. So I tend to, you know, listen to where the most need is for unlikely hikers. But in a way, over doing this, I have realized that sometimes it's the more quiet places that I probably need to be looking at and providing, you know, this experience for, because what might it take to amp up, you know, the recreation in the Midwest? And I mean, I know people are getting outside. I just think that because outdoor culture isn't so concentrated there, and when I say outdoor culture, I mean like very much brand sort of.
Yeah, you don't mean that people aren't actually doing it. You just mean the big brands aren't paying attention, right?
Yeah, but there's definitely this sort of hashtag outdoor culture that you see perpetuated on Instagram and social media that's very much like about a look and, you know, certain gear, making sure you have like, I don't know, some kind of, you know, Native American inspired blanket and like, you know, things like that. And I don't mean to be dismissive of all of that, but I think the outdoor culture is much more vast and varied than the image we generally tend to see. And I would like to have anything to do with, you know, showing how people in the Midwest are getting outdoors too.
Can I end by asking you guys, as you think about Jenny, as we're thinking about the conversation we were just having about the social media culture around your kind of like the hashtag outdoor culture, you've recently become a brand ambassador for REI. And I wonder whether you guys feel like the conversation is changing about what it looks like for people who spend time outdoors.
I definitely see change happening. I see and hear different conversations happening. And I think a lot of people are very curious about this conversation about diversity in the outdoors and, you know, wanting to catch up. I think REI has been a huge proponent of changing some of those narratives, or like rather focusing on it in their advertising campaigns, and also supporting, you know, grassroots causes like Unlikely Hikers. I see the change, but you know, something funny happens when things start to change. It sort of makes you focus or start thinking about what else needs to change. So it's a little bit of a domino effect in the sense that like, okay, great, we see this one thing changing, but this other thing really needs to change too. So sometimes it can feel like things can't move fast enough, you know, and people should never stop asking for more.
Aaron, what else needs to change?
I would say that more than anything, I definitely agree with Jenny in terms of the curiosity is this machine, and it's this domino effect, like Jenny said, that is causing people to, at the very least, look into more about what DEI work looks like and what it's about. And as long as we continue on that path of being curious and looking to understand, like, there are other perspectives, there are other experiences, and those experiences need to be expressed, need to be heard, and need to be voiced, then I would say that that is the change, at the very least, the beginning of the change that needs to occur.
That's Aaron O'Shea. He's the founder of Midwest Color Camp. I've also been speaking with Jenny Brusso, founder of Unlikely Hikers. You can check them out on Instagram. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It was wonderful.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, Illinois needs a lot more teachers. We're going to be speaking with people from the Golden Apple Scholars Program. They're trying to help close the gap through training and scholarships for people who want to work in classrooms. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.